Hello and Sarnai. Happy New Year, everyone. What sort of New Year should it be? Happy. You got that wish last year as well, didn't you? And the year before? This time round, we mean business. I want this year absolutely to be happier for you than the last one. Because now we know how to be happy. Now we know the true source of happiness is within. So therefore, step by step, little by little, we begin to stop seeking happiness from the outside. Because here on the outside, as long as you keep looking for that sort of happiness, it's always conditional. And you have begun to understand the risks and dangers of looking for conditional happiness. Because those conditions you don't have control over. Well, when there's no you, how can there be control over anything? So as we begin to contemplate on that and realize this truth, we look for an alternative way of fulfilling that happiness. And then we come across the Buddha's teaching. And then we realize all this time and effort that we've spent on a quest, looking for happiness to come to us from the external world, from others, from other material things. We're also very good at that. You know how successful you are at trying to, always trying to, find happiness from the outside world, trying to, but never really accomplishing anything. You know how successful you have been at that. But somehow, fate would have it, your lucky stars would have it, good fortune would have it, your merits would have it, that at some point in your life you were bound to come across the Buddha's teaching, and therefore here we are. This is not me I'm referring to. I'm only talking about the Buddha's teaching. That is why when we bring our palms together in veneration, I have never asked you to do so in my name. I'm just the messenger. So as they say, don't shoot the messenger, don't worship the messenger either. I'm just the messenger. I'm not the message. It is the message that is holy, because it is the message that frees us. If there's anyone you wish to worship and venerate and hold in high esteem, it is the supremely enlightened one, because he is the one who discovered the message. When asked, who is your teacher? He said, I don't have a teacher per se. I don't have a teacher in the way that you would expect me to answer this question. But my teacher is my teaching. My teacher is what I have understood. It is the Dhamma. It is what I have realized. And so when asked, Venerable Sir, after you are gone, who should we consider our teacher? He never nominated any individual. He didn't say the Mahanayaka Thero. Didn't say that. He certainly didn't mention me. So I am not your teacher. The Dhamma is your teacher. What I am doing is simply introducing you to your teacher. That's what I'm doing here. I seem to be very good at that. That much I'll admit. I know this is true because somehow I've managed to come across the best teacher I've found in my life, who is my Guru Hamguru. So I must be doing something right. Because if it is what you give, you get, then I seem to be very good at introducing people to their teachers. And so therefore my merits has brought me to who I believe, this is only my personal opinion, you can disagree with me if you choose to, the best teacher that one could ever find. And so I make it my life's effort to try and introduce you to my teacher and his students. The Mahasangha is here to help you save yourselves. You know, I am just a little drop in the ocean. I often think about this to myself. Our most loyal devotees who keep coming to Rajagiriya, I often think this to myself. You know, what I don't want you to do is to be my followers. That's not what I want for you to do. Because what happens when that happens is, when I'm gone, or if I go foul, if I go bad, if I go evil, then if you are just a blind follower, what happens to you? So that's not what I want for you. What I want for you is to seek refuge in the Sangha. The Sangha is not an individual. This is why I say, if I'm just a drop in the ocean, take a sip of that, just lap it up, and then get an idea of the ocean. Get a feeling for the ocean. If a drop tastes like this, then just imagine what the ocean must be like. That is what I want to be. Someone who can introduce you and someone who can get you in touch. A bridge that you can cross to seek the love, affection and care of the Mahasangha. If that is who has healed me, because I never healed myself, if the Mahasangha is who healed me, ladies and gentlemen, it is the Mahasangha who is going to heal you. The Mahasangha is not an individual. It is a virtue. It's a collection of virtues. It is a body. It is a body, it's a congregation that embodies all the noble qualities. I'm not even an arahant, so how can you consider me a Mahasangha? Even if I were an arahant, individually I'm not the Sangha. I'm just a member of the Sangha. Most of the time you'll only see what's good about me. I'll have my weaknesses, I'll have my flaws, my shortcomings. And those my teachers will pick, my fellow monks will pick up on, and they will advise me, and they'll guide me, and they'll counsel me, and they'll help me walk this path. So if I were to ask you to be my followers, then you will not only be picking up the good stuff, you'll also be picking up the bad stuff. So that is not what I want for you. I want you to be students of the sublime. I want you to be students of the perfect. And that is not me. But I'm only trying to help you bridge that gap from wherever you are to that infinite ocean of goodness, wholesomeness, greatness. And that is the Mahasangha. So through me, I want you to connect yourselves with the Mahasangha. That's what I want for you. So this is why I've got plans for... So next week I'll let you know what the date is. So we have a council at the monastery. Most senior monks, we get together every fortnight and we discuss and plan for the future of the monastery, how we're going to help and support our devotees, what plans we have for our monks and our anagarikas and anagarikas and so on. So that's happening tonight. So therefore I will be able to give you a date next week as to when you can come and spend some time with the Mahasangha. Because this is all you get otherwise. Just me. Just me is no good. I mean, if I'm so good, just imagine how good the Mahasangha must be. Huh? And I'm really pleased. I know we have not started yet. I'm really pleased that quite a few of you have now started seeking refuge in the Mahasangha. I see some of your faces at the monastery, sometimes for a day or two, sometimes for a week at a stretch. I've seen some people who come along and spend a couple of weeks there. This is what I want to happen for you. This is what I want to happen for you. And each of you who've come and spent some time at the monastery, even if it was a day, you know the difference that you've experienced. You know the transformation that you went through. And now you understand what I mean by it is not I who is your Savior. Each and every one of you, if any of you are willing to share your experiences, then make yourselves known and others can come and speak with you. Go and speak with them and ask them. So you went and spent a week at the monastery. What was it like? Is it all that Bhante hypes it up to be? Go and ask them. And ask them, is it really worthwhile? Do you get anything more than you get on a Sunday morning? Ask them. And then you will realize what it is that I mean. This is just a drop in the ocean. I can't give you more than that because I'm an individual. Alone we can only do so little. But together, we are an ocean. And I want you to join that. You need to be part of this mission. First of all, you need to be a carrier of the Dhamma. Before anything else. It is not your donations or your contributions that I'm looking for. Because before any of that will happen, you need to be a carrier of the Dhamma. Because people with money, people with offerings, there are many. But people who have really understood the Dhamma, people who have really absorbed the teaching of the Buddha, and therefore someone who can carry on the lineage of the Buddha, they are very few and far between. You know, that day will come when the sasana will perish. Not because there are no devotees to offer alms to the monks, to the sasana. Not because of that. But it is because there will not be any more individuals, men and women, who will have understood the teaching of the Buddha. On that day, the sasana will perish. Apparently, we have less than 2,500 years left. If the Buddha said so, it must be so. This is what I am striving to create with this community. People who have understood the Dhamma. People who can be messengers of the Dhamma. So that even one day, when this stops working, when this radio stops working, many more radios will have begun preaching. I know among you there will be those who will carry on this message, and that is the biggest offering you can make me. I want that to happen, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, already it's beginning to happen. That is why you are not here alone. That is why someone else you know is here as well. That's why you bring your parents. Always when you come up here and tell me, Swaminas, I've brought my parents along with me today, what do I tell you? Well done. That's what you ought to be doing. That's how you brought your brothers with you, your sisters with you. That's how you brought your friends with you, your neighbors with you, your colleagues with you. If these are the people you've spent the last 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years of your life, and if those were the people who were there with you in the rough times, in the tough times, in the difficult times, in the challenging times of your life, are they not the people we have to be grateful for? I mean, you've known me for what? For 6 months. I've just been delivering a bit of Dhamma for you. But what about those people who were always there to put up with you? When you were crying, they were there to give you a shoulder to cry on. When you were angry, when you were upset, they were there, tolerant, patient. What about those people? That's why if you can convince your husband to come along, you've been coming for the last 3 months. If you can convince your husband to come along, that's a huge victory on your part. I'll give one pat on the back to your husband, but three for you. Because that's something I can't do. It's something only you can do. Because that is a true testimony of how much you love him. Because it is to the people that we love we give the best things in life. Agreed? So this is merely a bridge. I can see you transform, ladies and gentlemen, and nothing makes me happier. I mean this from the bottom of my heart. When I see those smiles on your faces and I know that they are genuine, that they can't be taken away from you, they can't be stolen. Time and tide can't take it away from you. Nothing makes me happier. Because then I know that I have fulfilled the Buddha's task that he laid on my shoulders. It is a big task. It is not easy. Trying to convince someone who is happy that they're not happy. How do you do that? A man has his wealth. He has his women. He has his food. He has his property. And he thinks he's doing just fine. And you can't convince him that he's not. I mean, a sick man, a poor man, an elderly man, an almost dead man. Yes, easy. But with someone who's got youth on their side. I mean, look at all these young faces. Nothing makes me happier. The fact that beyond the joy of youth, I've been able to explain to you and show you that there's a bigger problem that you need to find a solution to. Nothing makes me happier. The fact that you have been convinced, I'm glad that we have been able to prosper the Dhamma. We have been able to spread the Dhamma. And the Dhamma is beginning to make a change in your lives. That's what we're here for. I'm glad about what we've been able to achieve over the last year together. This is not my doing. The Sasana is not a one-man band. Not even the Buddha can claim that, and he never did. People came because of the Buddha, but they stayed because of the Sangha. Yes, that's how it always worked. Guru Hamra always reminds us, people will come here, but I can't look after each and every one of them. You must do that. So the same is true for this community. You might hear this voice on a YouTube sermon. You might hear this voice on a podcast. You might hear it on a CD. You might hear it on the radio, on the TV, wherever. And you'll think, I want to try and listen to that. Maybe I should go on Sunday. Then they come. But they stay, not because of me. They stay because of the Sangha. So who's the Sangha? You only see two monks here. Where's the rest of the Sangha? Huh? Unfortunately, you can't see them. But I can. Because you're sat facing the wrong direction. Bhikkhu bhikkhuni upasaka upasika. This is the fourfold Sangha. Bhikkhu bhikkhuni are only two of them. That's only half of the Sangha. Upasakas and upasikas, where are they? Exactly. That's where they are. Let me give you a quick show of hands. Give me a show of hands if you have not... Now let me turn it the other way around. If you have experienced the love, the affection, the care of the people around you, the people in this community, if the reason you've been coming back, at least partly, is because of how well you've been treated by the people who are sat either side of you, give me a show of hands. You should see what I'm seeing right now, ladies and gentlemen. Look around. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Gee, you can make me happy. This is what we have accomplished. It's not the pirikara that you offer. This is what we have accomplished. A community that is a mission that is working towards Nibbana. Nothing more. You know you're not going to get anything else from here. I don't teach you how to do business or how to run the country. I teach you how to get to Nibbana. See? Each and every one of them, they put their hand up and said, it is not just the Swaminathan said, but it is that lady sat over there. It is that gentleman sat over there. It is that lady who sat two rows ahead of me and that gentleman who sat on my side. It is because of them I've been coming along. Marvelous. Marvelous. Thank you for the New Year's gift. Right. Let's bring our palms together then. In veneration of His holy name, He who is our Father, He who is our guide, He who is our Master, He who is the fount of all wisdom and the fountain of compassion and loving kindness, He who has taught us how to become who we are today, He who has shined infinite wisdom upon us and compassion upon us and helped us walk this path from good to great and from great to nobility. The reason that we are all here and the reason that we will all make our way to Nibbana and experience the ultimate bliss. To His name we make this holy veneration.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Now we have started making good progress into understanding, learning and comprehending some of the more profound aspects of the Buddha's teaching. So every week that passes by, we'll be making progress and steps forward on this journey. Therefore, it is important that you bear in mind that none of this is for academic interest, although it might sound academic. It might seem like it. So last week we talked about the digestive system. The week before that we talked about the elements and proteins and whatnot. So this is not a science class, as I'm sure you'll understand. Although this will be very interesting. These things will be pretty interesting. But I don't want you to stop at it being interesting. I want you to consider it enlightening. Interesting alone is not enough. If you don't understand some of the things that we talk about, so science stuff, the biology stuff, you know, the physics stuff, the chemistry stuff, it's not the end of the world as well. Now, there may be some in the audience to whom these ideas, you know, science was what you hated at school. Might be. Chemistry was what you hated at school, and today you thought that was it, 13 years of that, and I don't need to come across it anymore. And then you come to understand Nibbana, and lo and behold, Swami Mahase comes along and he starts teaching us chemistry again, or biology again. And then your Nibbana is lost at that time. You don't feel very Nibbanic. But I assure you, if some of the examples I bring up, and some of the analogies I bring up, the similes and the metaphors, if they don't make sense, it's not the end of the world. Because it's horses for courses, different things will make sense to different people, and that's perfectly fine. That's why, now today I also have a few other examples of my sleep. Sleep? Sleeve? Don't sleep. Now Swami knows us if they sleep, so we can just sleep now. Well, that was just a slip of the tongue. Don't sleep. And these are unrelated to science or chemistry or biology or physics. Well, I mean, I suppose you can't speak about the world unless you, without talking entirely about science. But some of the examples that I have brought along with me today, and I'll show them to you in a moment. I just want the penny to drop for you. That's it. Something here will make sense. One of these weeks will make more sense than the others. That's always the case. Some weeks will be better than others. And everyone will have a good week. Right? But there are a multitude of factors that contribute towards that. It's not just the Swami Mahase's preaching. It's how you got into the school today. How you got here today. It's, you know, your mood. A lot of factors contribute. How much joy you have in your heart. That's why oftentimes we talk about, you know, the goodness and merits and all that. All of those things create a wholesome environment in your mind. Anuttaram punya kettang. It is very essential. This is one of the qualities of the Sangha, right? Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sango. And then you end it with anuttaram punya kettang lokasa. Lokasati. That's how you recite it. The funny thing about these 24 virtues, the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, is it's actually on its head. That's how it is. It's turned around on its head. So you have to start the path with anuttaram punya kethan lokasa. You end it with itipi so bhagava arha. That's where you end. In fact, this is a journey that each and every one of us take. So even without you knowing it, every time you recite the noble virtues of the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, What you are really saying is, I am on that path. This is the journey. And this is my destination. See, there is no blind faith in Buddhism, ladies and gentlemen. You know, although we feel that we are chanting and we are venerating and we are worshipping individuals, your understanding of the teaching thus far must have convinced you that there are no such things called individuals. So the Buddha is not going to say, worship me. He would say, worship the qualities of the Buddha. So what he wants us to do is to subscribe to the qualities of the Buddha. It is not the Buddha, not the individual. The Buddha is a collection of qualities, a collection of virtues. These are the things that we aspire to instill within ourselves. But for that we have to start with Anuttaram Punya Kettan Lokasa. This is the 24th of an infinite number of virtues, but they have all been condensed into 24. So in the Buddhaguna chanting, you have 9. In the Dhamguna chanting, you have another 9. And then the rest in the Sanghaguna. Sanghaguna, forgive me for using the Sinhalese terms there. These are the qualities that make you Sangha. Makes who Sangha? Anyone. Not anyone, really. We are talking about a mind. Because what are you after all? Just mind and body, right? The 5 aggregates. So we can't transform any of the rupa to sangha. You can't do that because rupa is inherently patavi, apo, tejo and vayu. You can't change that. Patavi is hardness. You can't change that about rupa. It's a composition. Some portion of patavi, some portion of apo, some portion of vayu, some portion of tejo. Fluidity, solidness. These are qualities of rupa. You can't change that. So you are made up of stuff, and the qualities of those of that stuff is patavi, apo, tejo, vayu. So they call it the earth element, the wind element, the fire element, and the water element. So it's not really wind, earth, fire, and water that you're made of. Those 4 are used to represent them. Because when you talk about fire, what comes to mind is heat, right? When you talk about water, what comes to your mind is fluidity, cohesion. In fact, that is what is referred to there. Apo is cohesion. What keeps things together? The rupa together. The earth is used to represent solidness, hardness. So these are the qualities that any rupa, any form, have within them. They have them intrinsically. So you can't change that. But a chitta, the mind that you have, that can be transformed by the dhamma that you bear. After all, the dhamma is actually what you bear. That is the definition of dhamma. So what is Buddha Dhamma then? That which you bear in your mind that helps you to become Buddha is Buddha Dhamma. So change your definition of Buddha Dhamma to that from perhaps what you had in mind as what the Buddha taught. Yes, it is what the Buddha taught. But there's a more profound meaning to Buddha Dhamma. That which you need to bear in your mind that helps you to become Buddha is Buddha Dhamma. That is Buddha Dhamma. So what is Mara Dhamma? You heard of Mara? Yeah, so what is Mara Dhamma then? This is the opposite of Buddha Dhamma. That which you need to bear to be Mara. What is Mara? Vasavati Mara? No, Vasavati Mara is a god, is a deity. In the Paranimitta Vasavati. That's why it is called the Paranimitta Vasavati. So they're a clan of gods. In the Paranimitta Vasavati, which is one of the heavenly planes, there are a clan of gods called the Vasavattis. Now you may refer to a young child who's mischievous as that as well, Vasavartya. Why do people use that term? Because, you know, there was one among them. They're not all like that. In this Vasavati clan, there is one among them He is referred to as a Vasavatimara. And what he did was he challenged the Buddha on multiple occasions. And he challenged the Bodhisattva on multiple occasions. So he doesn't want people to attain Nibbana. Because in the Vasavati heavenly plane, he believes there's heavenly bliss. It's bountiful. It's heavenly bliss. So if there's heavenly bliss up there, why is it that the Buddha comes along and says, all is suffering. Free yourself from suffering. Aspire to Nibbana. This is the problem that he has. So I'm referring to one specific God in the Vasavati heavenly plane. But Vasavati is not his name. Vasavati is the name of that clan of gods. Just like your Manusa. They are Vasavati. But among them, there's one of them. So that is not Mara. I mean, that is Mara. But the Mara that I refer to, in this instance, is that Dhamma that you need to bear in your mind, which makes you believe that you are Ma. What is Ma? Me. Again, I refer to the Sinhalese term there. So you must forgive me. From time to time, I'll jump because to help you understand some of these concepts, I will make reference to the Sinhalese terms, but I'll explain them to you because there are individuals who listen to these sermons online and who will who will not speak or understand the Sinhalese language, but that's okay. What makes you feel that you are Ma? Are you Ma? What, Jack Ma? Who is it I refer to as Ma? Me. Whoever you are, you all sense a me, don't you? The funny thing is, you sense the same me that I do. Although we feel that we are so unique, you sense the same me that I do. But you have some data which are add-ons onto that fundamental me that makes you believe that you are different. Because the same causes will always lead to the same results. What are the conditions? What are the causes that bring about a sense of self? Have we covered some of this so far? I think we have, yes. What are the causes that bring about a sense of self? Ignorance and attachment. We'll go over them, you know, it's fine. This is just some easy, quick Q&A, right? So these are the causes. That ignorance and attachment are the causes that give rise to a sense of self. Now, no matter where this ignorance and attachment is, it will always give rise to the same sense of self. So then how come we are so different from each other? Not just the external aspects I'm talking about. How come you feel that you are so different to each other? Let me explain to you. For instance, why do you feel that you are a man? Let's take two minds. So I'm talking about you and I'm talking about you. Two minds. Two individuals, two minds. Okay? At the most basic level, you have ignorance and attachment. Same here. Ignorance and attachment. These two causes are identical. So if the causes are identical, what can you tell me about the results? They have to be identical. I'm talking you through the steps that make you feel not just that you are an individual, but that you are a man. I mean, it's funny, isn't it, how a mind begins to feel and perceive that it's a man? The mind is, after all, just an energy. Tell me, what is man about you? What is so manly about you? What is it about you that makes you a man? What qualifies you to consider yourself a man? What qualifies you to consider yourself a woman? Is it any aspect of the mind, do you think? Do you? If you were born blind, you wouldn't know what you were. As you look at yourself in the mirror, as you look at others, the reason that you think you are a man, the reason that you think you are a woman, ladies and gentlemen, is because you look at this figure. You look at your bodies. And then you attach this idea that this is you and this form to this basic ignorance and attachment and sense of self. So this is what creates an I. In both instances, these eyes are identical. They are identical. That's why I've drawn the three lines. Those who've done maths will know. Two signs equals an equal. Three means they're identical. These two are identical. So at the very basic level, you know, if we stopped here, so I'm talking about the chitta arising. Okay? This is the chitta now, or beginning to arise. And the same happening here. If we were to stop here, none of you would be able to tell yourself apart from another. None of you. You will all sense self in the same way, in the same way that the ant that's crawling on the floor right now is feeling the sense of self. The same way. But you feel that you are an animal, you feel that you are a human being, you feel that you are a man, you feel that you are a woman, you feel that you are young, you are elderly, you are grown up. All of these things happen after this. See, if there are conditions that have to keep adding up before the full picture of who you are is formed, then are you really that? You are the baggage that you carry. See, each chitta must build up who you are piece by piece. If that is so, who are you? If each chitta has to build you up, your definition of who you are is dependent on what builds up here. So let me talk you through what happens after this. At this stage, we are all identical. If we were to stop here, you'd all just stop at I. That's it. You won't be able to complete this sentence. You'll stop at this. I am. What is am? Just think about it for a second. What is am? We've always used it. We always use it all the time. What is am? Am is a be verb, right? It's a conjugation. Oh, we thought we've come here for Nibbana. Last week it was biology. Previous week it was chemistry. This week it's English. Back to school. Am is a conjugation of the be verb. When you apply it to the personal pronoun, very interesting, isn't it? When you conjugate it to the personal pronoun, first person, be verb conjugation is am. So, when you say I am, what are you actually referring to? Existence. That is how you know that existence exists. When you say I am. You needn't say anything else after that. I am alone qualifies your existence. Don't you all feel I am? Don't you all feel I am? That's it. You know, this is a sentence. You can put a full stop there. I am. Someone says, I am what? No. That's a whole complete sentence. Is it not? Yeah. I am. But we don't stop at I am, because the chitta doesn't stop here. It doesn't stop at just ignorance and attachment and the sense of self. Things start piling up beyond that. Because here's what you have. You have a pair of eyes. For your sins, you have a pair of eyes. And what do your eyes do? It brings in images. Now I'm trying to explain to you who you are and why you believe You're a man, you're a woman, you're a mother, you're a father. Each chitta has to construct this. That's why etang santang etam panitang yadidang sabba sankara samatho. You know, each chitta is laboriously constructing who you are in every single instance of it. Because it is just a chitta, ladies and gentlemen. How can a chitta feel that it's male? Just think about it. How can a chitta feel that it's male? How can a chitta feel that it's female? How can a chitta feel that it's a mother? A chitta is just a chitta. It's just an energy. It's just a packet of energy. Excuse me. So how does a chitta go from being a chitta, which is just an energy? Now, remind me, what does a chitta do? What are the five things? Receive, register, recognize, respond, and perceive, right? These are the five things a chitta is supposed to do. Not think that it's a male. I want you to understand the difference between knowing male and being male. This is deep, by the way. So may your merits come to fruition from this point forward. I didn't expect to speak any of this today. There's a difference between knowing male and being male. There's nothing wrong with knowing male. Male or female, there's nothing wrong with knowing this. What's wrong is being this. See, the five things that a chitta is supposed to do is to receive, register, recognize, respond, and perceive. You can do those five things with male and female. That's fine. You can receive male, not emails. What I mean by receive male is, you look at a figure. Okay? This is just a skanda. This is just rupa. You look at this rupa, and there's a name that's given to this rupa. All collections have names. We give them names for convenience. Right? This is a fan. This is a pen. These are all collections of matter, aren't they? Held together with energy. That's why when you add energy to this, this changes. Hold it under a fire. This shape changes. It distorts. It warps. Becomes something else. The same goes for everything. Everything has a melting point. What that means is, how much energy you have to add to change the construction, the composition of that matter. So male is one construct. One way in which matter has come together, we call it a configuration. That is male. It's okay to know male. Do you understand what I'm trying to explain to you here? To know male is to perceive male. And perceiving happens after receiving, registering, recognizing, responding, and then you have perception. Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, and Vijnana. By the point you get to Vijnana, you have now, you know male. That's it. You know what male entails. What is male? If someone asks an arahant the question, what is male, venerable sir? He's not going to say, I don't know, I'm an arahant. He's not going to say that. So then you have to ask him, what is an arahant then? I don't know, because I'm an arahant. He's not going to say that. He's going to tell you exactly what a male is. I mean, was it not the Buddha who laid down rules of conduct for the monks and the nuns? And he said the monks and nuns should keep their distance. So then, did the Buddha not know male and female? I mean, the Buddha, after all. When Visakha came into the monastery, the Buddha would ask her, Visakha, why are you here at this ungodly hour? What's happened to you? I've lost a grandchild, venerable sir. This is why I come at this ungodly hour. Please, would you help me? said Visakha. So when he saw Visakha, he didn't ask, Ananda, why are you here? I am a Buddha because I don't know the two. I don't know the difference between the two. No, this is madness. Don't you ever fall into that trap. Because there will be some schools of thought that will tell you, if you recognize something, something's wrong with you. At that point, suffering happens. No. Your recognition of things is not the cause of suffering. Because Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana are not the cause of suffering. Ignorance and attachment are. But some people, they go astray. I only say this to you out of compassion because I don't want you to fall into that trap. There will be some people who will start training and practicing themselves to, you know, along a certain discipline, some kind of meditation, and at the end of that, you show them an object, they'll say, I don't know. Now you've got to feed them because they don't know how to eat. They don't know their left from right. They don't understand oncoming traffic. So now they can't travel, they can't walk on the road, basically that becomes a vegetable. Now you have to do everything for them. Because it's possible, you can do that. You can do that by training your mind to not recognize things. You can do that, it's entirely possible. Don't try it at home, but it's possible. And it's very dangerous. People who practice that, they're born in this world called the Asanya Sattva. And once they're there, they're there for a very long time. There are no Buddhas there. It's one of the Arupavachara realms. There's no Rupa there. There's no form. Just the mind, but it doesn't take any Sanya, because that is what it has trained. And therefore, it'll be there for eons at a stretch. And at the end of that karma, they're again born in one of the worldly realms. So it is pointless. So the problem is not with recognition. So to know male is fine. To be male is not fine. Which one's happening with you right now? Think of your husband for a second, those of you who have a husband, those of you who have a son, think of your sons, think of your father. When you think of them, you can't help yourself from thinking that they are male, can you? You can't help yourself from thinking that. You feel that they are male. Therefore, what you believe is, there's a sentient being who's a male. So you don't just know male. You be male. That is what's happening with you right now as well. Female. The same goes on. If you believe that you are a female, then your chitta, which has identified itself as a self, then starts piling up other pieces of information. And one step at a time, it builds up a profile of you. And that is that profile that you finally perceive. And then you believe that that is the truth. Is it too much on a Sunday morning? I don't know. I confess, this is actually quite profound. I didn't expect to speak to you about this so early. But now that I've started, I don't know how I can turn back. Shall we continue or should you like me to show you a cartoon or something? Shall we continue? Okay. But hang in there, okay? As I said, there will be some weeks where everything will make sense to you. There will be some weeks where a little bit will make sense, but most of it won't. It's okay. That doesn't mean you're a bad student. That doesn't mean you're not intelligent or you're not diligent. It doesn't mean any of that. It's just that week it didn't make a lot of sense. That's all. So don't let one week define your path to Nibbana. It's not like that. It's never like that. I mean, there are times when my teacher preaches to me. At the end of that, I'm like, what? And then I have to go back to him. And sometimes I listen to the recording again. And then I'll go back and question him. And he says, before you ask me any questions, go back and watch it again. Then I go back and watch it again. And then I come back again. And then he says, right, now do you understand? Okay, what questions still remain? And then I explain to him, and then he gives me the answers. Then it makes sense. That's it. I mean, what else do I have to do? So I assure you, even if some of these things don't make a lot of sense, and then there's the other side as well. What if you misunderstand what I'm trying to explain to you? Now that can give rise to fear in your hearts. What if I understood something, but is that exactly what Swaminathan meant? Now if I'm practicing something that's completely absurd, is that going to get me on the wrong path? Not if you keep bringing yourself here. Because even if you've understood something incorrectly, the next week I'm going to say something. Something's going to be said, and then you're going to try and reconcile the two. And then you're going to realize, oh, hold on. That's not what he said last week. He's saying something completely different this week. So either I misunderstood him, or he's gone nuts. Something's not right. So either you'll try to reconcile it yourself, or you might come later on and ask, Swaminathan, last week you said this, this week you said this, what's the connection between the two? So, all is fair game. Okay? I don't expect each and every one of you to take away 100% of what I have shared with you today. In fact, I don't have the words to explain 100% of what I'm trying to explain to you right now. Some of these talks I've never done before. So, in what I mean by this, some of the concepts that I'm trying to explain to you, because sometimes these concepts come up for the first time in the Saturday sermons at the monastery. Sometimes they come up for the first time in the Sunday sermons at Rajagiriya. Sometimes they come up on a poe day when I get a chance to speak to our devotees in Sinhalese at the monastery. Sometimes they come up for the first time when I'm speaking to one of my students or giving a talk to the monks. There's no time or place for any of this. When the conditions are right, it manifests. That's how it works. So that is why you don't... Sudarshanandra always tells me, Swaminathan, why don't you speak to... Like, you start with something. And then you divert. And then you go sidetracking. And then you never come back and finish the story. I feel for these devotees. He tells me. Apparently last week I started a story and I never completed it. He tells me off. That's because I don't come here with a prepared speech. This is all improvised. I don't have a script. I honestly promise you, I don't have a script anywhere. I don't need one when you come here with merits. I don't need one. But if I was speaking to a rubber tree, then I need a script. I need to practice myself and come and talk to you. But you come up here, you nod your heads when you understand things. You go this way when you don't understand things. And when you're really not getting it, you go like this. Then I get it. That is the feedback that I get. So it's constantly coming from you. And then your merits, my merits, everything comes together. And it's not just your merits. If you and you sit down here, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to resolve. Now see, now we're sidetracking. This is what happens. When you come and sit down to listen to a sermon, don't just come here for your own Nibbana. There are many others for whom it is their destiny to walk in the path that you show them, not I show them. Let me say that again. There are many who will walk on a path that you will be showing, not I will be showing. So therefore, if someone is to come here in 3 weeks' time, in a month's time, if someone is to ask you one day, hey mate, you are very different from the person you used to be. What's going on with your life? Are you on something? See, for them to ask that question, they have to have witnessed a transformation within you. Your speech, the way you speak, the words you speak, the kindness, the compassion that you begin to demonstrate, that is what's going to get them to ask those questions. So therefore, you're listening to the Dhamma, or you're listening to the Dhamma, is not purely, merely for your own benefit. There are many others who are bound to walk in your footsteps, and you are going to be their guide. Not me. I can't do this alone. This is not a one-man band. It's a Sangha that does this, and you are the Upasakas and the Upasikas. So do it not just for yourself, but for all those who are about to walk on your footsteps. Right, let's come back. When a chitta arises, lots of magic happens. I'm trying to explain to you a few of those steps and why a chitta begins to feel that it is a man, a woman, a girl, a boy, a doctor, an engineer, a teacher, whatever. Remember, was it here or at the monastery, we talked about personas. Was it here? Okay. Personas. When you're speaking to your child, for those of you who have children, when you speak to your child, what do you feel you are? Mothers feel their mothers, fathers feel their fathers. When you're speaking to your sibling, do you feel the same way? Certainly not. At that moment you feel you're a brother or you're a sister. All of this is going on in a chitta. When you're speaking to your parents, now you feel you're a child. When you're speaking to a stranger, you feel that you're a stranger to them. When you're doing the role of a teacher, you feel you're a teacher and they are students. These are the various personas, the various personas that incarnate in your own mind. It's not one mind that forever exists. These are individual chittas that arise and pass away. So this is what we call mental incarnations. You've heard of the word incarnation. Often people ask the question, is reincarnation a concept that Buddhism accepts? I say yes, it is. So, but you needn't worry about whether it's something that happens after death, because death is a highly glorified concept. People give it far more credit than it deserves. Death is not a big deal. Death is just where the chitta stops arising in this body and it starts arising in another body. That's it. So, I mean, think about this for a second. You are stood here. Okay? So chitta arises and passes away. If you could move that body an inch to the left before the next chitta arises, what's happened now? Are you going to tell me that that's the same body? With your understanding of the Dhamma right now, manifestations and all that, how things are only there in that moment because the causes come together in that moment, therefore they manifest in that moment. Is it the same body that has moved one step to the left? It's not. These are merely manifestations in those moments. That's why we call it pachuppanna. Yeah? So therefore, don't you believe that death is just too glorified? People think far too much about death. Once we begin to understand the crux of the Dhamma, death, it's nullified. Death is a mental concept. So the chitta arising in one body and in the next moment it arises in another body, that's all that happens. So I ask you this question. When you are speaking to your child, you feel that you are a mother, you are a father. So in that moment, you don't feel that you are a sibling. Those thoughts don't come to you, those emotions don't come to you, those feelings don't come to you, do they? They certainly don't. If you are the boss of the company, if you are a leader and you are speaking to your people, right? This is why people are very different in different situations. Because it's not the same person that's there everywhere. These are all individual chittas. There is some connection to each other, yes, but they are still individual chittas. On their own, they're a chitta. They don't need the support of another chitta or the one before it or the one after it. Each chitta is well and truly a chitta. Every chitta will create an environment for the next chitta. That's how chittas work. It's like a parent creates an environment for their children, they for their children, they for their children and so on. So when your children were born, they were probably born into the house that you built. Yeah, that's where you brought them. And they were probably driven in the car that you bought. And they probably inherited the money that you earned. So therefore, as a parent, we create an environment for our children. In the same way, ladies and gentlemen, in the same manner, each chitta as it arises and passes away, it creates an environment for the next chitta. That's why when you do things, I mean, you know, we need to apply these concepts to understand our behaviors. That's why when you start doing something, you finish it, generally speaking. Like, you know, say when you want to clap your hands, you don't bring your hands together and all of a sudden, what am I going to do? Why are my hands together? You don't ask that question. Unless you have short-term memory loss. What happens is you clap. And then if you're actually celebrating something, you keep on clapping. You do it for a few seconds. How come if these are all individual chittas, each chitta follows the footsteps of the previous one? How come they follow a certain pattern? It's because each chitta creates the environment for the next one. But if the environment changes, all can change. For instance, you are clapping. Now this used to happen, this happened once. It's a funny story. Well, it's funny for me, might not be fun for you. One day I was giving a sermon, at the end of the sermon everyone started clapping. Say, well done, Swami. This was at a school, young children, international school. So the teacher intervened then. Of course, the teacher understands that, you know, you don't clap at the end of a Swami Nasya's sermon. So he says, oh, stop. But I bring your hands together and you say, sadhu. That's what you do. Say, sadhu. Now, as a child started clapping, they wanted to, you know, they were really happy about the sermon. So this is their way of saying sadhu. I mean, you know, you can rejoice in many ways. Some people throw flowers. That is their way of rejoicing. Some people sing hymns. That's their way of rejoicing. Some clap. Some dance. Some worship. Each one to themselves as to how they rejoice. And that's perfectly fine. So we don't stop the children and say, how dare you clap at the Swami Nasa? You'll go to hell for that. We don't do that. How can you go to hell for clapping? It is intention that is karma. What is their intention after all? To rejoice. That is the way in which they show their piety, their devotion. They're joyful, they're happy about what has just happened. So they clap. That's okay. So if at some point your child starts clapping at the end of a sermon, don't slap them. Let them clap. And after they're done clapping, just talk to them. Buddha, normally in society, when a monk or a priest or someone does a sermon, we don't generally clap like this. What we do is we bring our palms together and we do this. That is what we do. Then they'll ask you why, and then I'll leave it to you to find out the answers to that. So anyhow, the point I was trying to make was, when you start clapping, you finish clapping. You don't like stop, like you don't do 1.5 claps, right? You clap. That is because each chitta creates the environment for the next chitta, unless something intervenes. It could be a drishti. Generally it is. It could be another sensation. Maybe they say you're clapping and all of a sudden you start to feel a cramp in your arm. Now you stop. That is not a drushti from somewhere. That's just a sensation that you've just had. So therefore now it's a different environment. Because the environment has changed, now the causes have changed and therefore the effect is different. That's how things work. So stop giving credit to yourselves. Don't you think that it's I who started clapping and it's I who has now stopped clapping? That's not how it works. You know, this I business, it is always an afterthought. I'll explain to you how all that works. The I is always an afterthought. Chakkun cha pati cha rupe cha upajyati chakku vinyana. The Buddha says, as an object comes into contact with the I consciousness is born. So that is not the I consciousness. I'm talking about the eye consciousness. Okay? Chakku is the eye. Rupa is the form or the object. The form object. So as these two come together, come into contact, eye consciousness is born. In that moment, ladies and gentlemen, there is no eye. In your chitta, when that happens, you have no sense of self at all. So I'm breaking down the series and the steps, the sequences of you, a chitta being born here. We would never have been able to see this without the Buddha explaining and describing this to us. I mean, can you catch a single chitta Even if you feel you do, you're not actually referring to one chitta. You're talking about the millions of chittas. Our minds can never look at itself. You can't do that. So we need the Buddha's infinite wisdom. His omniscience is what has helped us to understand the world in this manner. That's why I say he's not an empirical scientist. He doesn't experiment and learn. His paramita helps him to realize. What he has realized, he encourages us to learn by experience. That's why he says in the Kalama Sutta, don't take it just because I say so. Why does he say that actually? Does he not know that what he's saying is the truth? I mean, think about that for a second. Another sidetrack. Think about it for a second. Why does the Buddha, who knows well and truly that everything he says, every syllable he utters is nothing but the absolute truth? What, does the Buddha not have confidence in himself? Is that why he says, you know, I'm not sure about this, but you know, don't take my word for it. Take it and go and ask someone. If they also agree, then accept it. Is it because the Buddha is not sure about what he's saying? No. So why does he say that then? Why do I always encourage you to take what you have learned here into the lab of life? Because it needs to go beyond knowledge and it has to become your internalized conviction. It has to be true for you. It can't be true for you just because it's true for me. That is bhakti. Remember Bhakti Gita from Dhampasa? Bhakti is one, Shraddha is another. They are not one and the same. In Buddhism, we don't have bhakti, although we sing Bhakti Gita. That is not what the Buddha wanted for us. Nowhere in the Tripitaka have I still yet come across an instance where the Buddha refers to bhakti. He refers to Shraddha. Shraddha is conviction. Conviction can only happen when something is true for you. That is how conviction happens. So therefore, it is not just faith. Buddhism is not a faith. It's a conviction. Because you can't aspire to Nibbana unless and until it is true for you. Don't you get that? Because it's all happening within you. There is nothing I can do for you. I'm only the wayfarer. The Buddha can't be your savior. He can only guide you. You have to take that step. Therefore, with bhakti alone, with faith alone, you can't do this. Faith might get you here. It might get you onto the track. It might bring you to the sermons. But then after that, you have listened to the Dhamma, and the Dhamma has to start making sense for you. And then you go from, what was it? Faith to conviction. That is Shraddha. And the Buddha says, one who has a modicum of conviction towards the Buddha. Now, you need to think what Buddha means here. I've explained to you enough now for you to figure what I mean by the Buddha here. So the Buddha says, one who has a modicum of conviction towards the Buddha is not one who will ever go to the four great hells. Now think about what he says there. Who is he referring to? Who is he referring to? A sotapanna. At least someone who's on the path to attaining sotapanna. He says, one who has a modicum of conviction towards the Buddha. So one who has a modicum of conviction towards the Buddha has begun to realize that the Buddha is not a person, right? They have begun to see that Buddha is the destiny, is the destination of this journey of the Dhamma, and that is Nibbana. Of course, one who has seen Nibbana for the first time is a what? He's the sotapanna. They're a stream enterer. They've seen the destination of the stream. They know that this leads to the ocean. That is why we call them the stream enterers. Now, is it not obvious that a stream enterer does not enter the four great hells? Yes, well, that's what the Buddha is saying in a different verse. Back here. These are little bonus lessons from time to time, okay? So, how does the chitta become you? I'm breaking it down step by step. Let's come back here. Let me draw you how the eye and rupa come into contact. There's your rupa. There's the eye. Now, when you think eye, most of you will be thinking about the physical eye. That is only part of your eye. Because the physical eye, all it does is it converts light energy to electrical energy. That's all it does. But there are other parts of your physiology that are responsible for converting that electrical impulse into what the mind will interpret as a rupa-rupa. Okay? As a sight object. So, let's just say that is the brain and all parts of that. We've spoken about this, some of this stuff previously. So, you have the optic nerve that comes and feeds the brain, and the brain somehow creates a rupa-rupa for the mind to process. Chakkuncha paticca rupecha. Chakkuncha, all of this. Chakkuncha paticca rupecha uppajjati chakku vijnana. While this is happening, you, the self, has not even woken up yet. So how can you say it is I who see? If you are not even there yet. At this point, this is just what we call a chakku vijnana. In the chakku vijnana, there is no self. If we stopped at this point, there would just be seeing. Or at least a fragment of that. The whole mental process hasn't gone through yet. The whole mental process hasn't gone through yet. So, after the chakku vijnana happens, so you can call it the rupa rupa or you can call it the chakku vijnana. Okay? Either of these two is fine. This object is now fed into the mind process. See how intricate this process is and what level of wisdom one needs to not understand this, but to realize this for the first time without a teacher. I'm just reminding you how great your father is. That's all. Just reminding you that the Buddha is peerless. Oh, how lucky you are. You don't know how lucky you are yet. You will one day once you understand what I have understood today. You know some aspect of how lucky you are, but not fully. Because you are my past, still. You are still my past. One day you will become my present. Then you will understand, as I understand today, how lucky you are. You get what I'm saying? Yeah? Then you will understand how I understand today, how lucky you are. But today you are my past. So you think, oh wonderful, the Buddha's teaching, he's great. I'm beginning to understand this stuff. Yes, but you don't know the extent to which you are lucky and fortunate. Sidetrack, come back again. So, now we have the chakku vijnana. This chakku vijnana now has to be fed through the mental process so that it can become a mano vijnana. Because you need to perceive this. You need to make sense of it. A sight object alone is powerless. It doesn't do much. You need to know how to interact with it. You need to know how to respond to it. Now you begin to hear some familiar words. You need to know how to register it. You need to know how to perceive it. So therefore, a mental process now needs to commence. That is where the I process hands over the baton to the mind. All of this is happening, I can't say in a flash of a second, because it is not in a flash of a second. It's in like a trillionth of a second. All of this is happening. Now let's see what happens. This becomes the rupa. So don't confuse this rupa with this rupa. They're all referred to as rupa. You know, in these teachings you will find the same name appear in multiple places. In some places, vijnana will simply be referred to as an arahant vijnana. In other places, it will be referred to as a defiled mind, and so on. Right? So here, we are just talking, that's why I'm explaining the process to you. All of this, ladies and gentlemen, happens even in an arahant. Nothing is defiled about this, nothing is wrong about this, nothing is foul about this. And therefore, no what? Suffering. No suffering here. So you see, there's no suffering in sight. Sights don't bring you suffering. They don't bring you happiness either. They're equanimous. That is what the arahant has realized. Equanimity, upeksha. He has understood the true nature of all rupa. Now we have the chakku vijnana. That becomes the object to the mind. All good so far? Yes? If this didn't make sense to anyone, can just give me a show of hands. I can go over it again. Just so far. Made sense? Perfect. Let's continue then. So this is the object that now has to be processed by the mind base. All this is happening in the eye base. Now you have the rupa. So this chakku vijnana itself becomes this rupa. The rupa which is the object to the mind. So what happens after the rupa happens? So this is the receiving. See, now you see where it's received from. All this while we've been talking about receiving. Receiving, receiving, receiving. Receiving from where, Swami Nuhansa? Now you get receiving from where? Receiving through the eye door. If you replace here a sound and a ear, now what do you get? The sound door. Or the ear door. Then if you replace it with a taste and tongue, now you have the tongue door. This is how you have the five senses. You can also have the mind door. Like when you shut down yourself, there are five senses, but you're thinking about things. That can also happen. Memories, for instance. So you have a six sense doors. Now you have the rupa, then you have the vedana. So this is received and now it's registered. Then you have the sanya. So this object is now recognized. See, it is at this point you begin to recognize what you have just seen. Until then, there is no recognition of what is seen. Because the eye is not the bit that recognizes. It's the mind that recognizes. Then you have sankara. Now, another sidetrack. What happens when you're in a coma? Are they just shut down? Completely blank, nothing's going on. I mean, that must be peace then, mustn't it? Why try to revive someone from a coma? They seem to be as peaceful as can be. Let me tell you what's happening in a coma. All of these five sense doors, they're shut down. They're not working because something's physically wrong with this body. But the mind base is still well and truly active because the coma doesn't knock out the mind. It knocks out the physiology, it knocks out the body, the physical aspects of it. The mind is still functioning. And here's the danger of it. The mind wishes to see. Uh-oh. What's not working though? The eye isn't working. Imagine being blind, deaf, numb to taste, numb to sense of touch. You get where I'm going with this? What's the other sense organ? Smell. Numb to all smells, all five at the same time. Imagine being all five at the same time. Has the mind freed itself from the desire to see? From the desire to hear? The desire to smell and taste? Of course not. But the five sense organs are not working. But the mind is still actively looking for inputs. The only sense door that is open at the time is the mind itself. So there are memories, potentially. But if the brain is also part of the affected organs, then you can't access most of your memories either. But you're still alive. Because how can the heart beat if the mind is not working? Every time a chitta arises, ladies and gentlemen, there are three things that happen. with this chitta energy, one aspect of it goes into creating the world around you. I'll explain these later on. Just for the time being, just bear it in mind. How and why these things happen and the science behind it. You know, I'm not a monk, so I don't take anything at face value. That is why, that is one of the reasons I revere my teacher, because I am not someone who is easily convinced. So to be able to have a, to have been able to explain things in a way that I can understand, must be, he must be the real deal. To be able to explain things in a way that I can understand and answer all my questions. He's the oracle, I call him. Sidetrack. Come back again. I get carried away when I talk about teachers and parents and goodness and greatness in the world and the Buddha and so on. I just get carried away. So my sins. Where were we? What were we talking about? Coma. Yes. You know, in a state of coma, you begin to question, where is Ma? Ko? Ma? Why? Because what defines Ma? What defines you? All of the things that you've been using from the external world to define who you are, it's all gone. You can't see anything, you can't hear anything, you can't smell anything, you can't taste anything, you can't feel anything. But the mind's constantly trying to build this profile of who you are. But where is it getting get its inputs from? And if the brain is impacted, you can't access memories either. Now? It's like an engine that is revving, but is not allowed to move. Take an engine off gear and hit on the pedal. After a while, it begins to burn out. It starts to overheat. This is what's happening in a person who is in a coma. So don't ever wish it on anyone. Although it seems like they're in a state of peace and bliss, far from it. If someone dies in a coma, that's a very sorry state to be in, because their mind is in utter vexation. No hope of relief from that vexation, because to relieve from vexation, you need to give the object of their desire. That's the only way the mind knows to relieve itself from vexation. What you want to see when you're presented with that object, you are relieved from vexation. Now the mind still wants to see things, but eyes aren't working. The ears aren't working. The nose isn't working. The tongue isn't working. The body isn't working. It's trying to build up this profile of itself, but it can't get the inputs that it needs. So therefore, this process has now stopped. So therefore, the mind base cannot any longer receive rupa as objects, as inputs. So let's come back to a healthy person. So this is what's happening with you right now. You have the rupa that is then registered as vedana. You then identify, recognize it as with sanya. Excuse me. Respond to it with sankhara. And then finally, you perceive it through vijnana. Now you see, this vijnana, another vijnana. This is all happening with the mind. The mind wouldn't be able to do any of this if the five sense doors or the six sense doors weren't functioning. Because these are the input doors to the process that is the mind. Have you all got that so far? All good with that? Alright. Now what is the problem then? Does this not happen in an arahant? Absolutely does. This happens in an arahant, this happens in an arahant. They both happen in an arahant. But here's what doesn't happen. This is the mind base that we speak of, two individuals. In an arahant, there is no desire to experience an identity. There is no need to experience a separation. There is no need to experience an entity, because they have realized and comprehended entirely, fully, thoroughly, that there are no such things called entities in this world. That all there are manifestations. I hope the chicken lesson from last week helped some aspect. to some extent. Remember the chicken lesson? Yes. Although you thought that you are you, now you begin to understand that you are just a chicken processed. And then you thought a chicken was a chicken, now you realize that chicken is not chicken, it's just you waiting to happen. Then your ashes, they're not ashes, that's just chicken. Gone through a number of stages. So then therefore nothing is anything. Nothing is anything fixed. Nothing is anything of an entity. All are merely manifestations that present themselves to the world in the state that they are, in the circumstances that they are, in the environment that they are. That's all. Is water water and ice ice? It's just hydrogens and oxygens doing what they do in that environment. Change the room temperature, or change the temperature of the environment, and ice is no longer water, and water is no longer ice. So ice is not a fixed state. It's merely a manifestation in the circumstances, in the environment. So therefore, do you now begin to realize, ladies and gentlemen, for your own sakes, that even you, all of you, and all aspects of you are merely manifestations. So your bodies are pure manifestations. It is only in this condition, in this state, in the present environment. Change one aspect of that environment and that's it, you're no longer. If we were to blow up a nuclear bomb within our vicinity, right? Those atoms, those neutrons, they would pierce your bodies. Because they'll be able to get through what you're made up of and disintegrate you entirely in a flash of a second. That's what happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. When the atom bombs went off, anyone stood within several kilometers of the epicenter, they disintegrated. No, they didn't fall dead. They disintegrated. Because it's just matter held together with energy. That's it. So change the amount of energy that you apply on a body, and what happens? That configuration changes. That is all that's working with you right now. Energy is keeping this matter together. Energy keeps the electron around an atom in its orbit. That is energy that keeps doing that. Energy keeps the protons and the neutrons together. It keeps electrons in close vicinity to the nucleus. This is all energy. We call it gravitational energy. Call it what you like. The sun and the solar planets, or the planets of the solar system, they're all affected by energy that keeps this matter in a certain configuration. The same goes for you as well. If you were to expand the distance between an electron and a nucleus, which is all what you're made of, really, most of you, or really much of you, is actually empty space. To think of it, much of you is nothing. Didn't your mother tell you that? No, honestly. If you consider the volume of an atom, much of it is just empty space. So if your cells are formed of the stuff that we talked about last week, the molecules, and the molecules are formed of atoms, and if the volume of an atom is mostly empty space, then what are you mostly? Empty space. But to the naked eye, you don't see this. Because an atom is very small. So you don't see the empty space between them. I want you to think about yourselves in a different light. What for? So we have something to do on a Sunday morning? No, no. Why are we doing this? To free yourselves from suffering. To free all of us from suffering. So that I can help you understand that the concept of death is merely a concept. So that the concept of old age, because you know what, folks, if you don't get this stuff, in a few days, few weeks, few months, few years' time, you'll be crying bucket loads when your dear and loved ones will depart you. I know this Dhamma is true, not purely from my own personal experience, but there are those among you who have come and shared their stories with me. Swami Nuhansa, my husband passed away 2 weeks ago. My mother passed away last night. 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Thanks to the Dhamma, I was able to keep myself steady. I reflected on the words that you shared with me and I contemplated, is she really dead? Or is it just the fact that the chitta no longer arises in this body? Where was the mother to begin with? These are the testimonies that have been coming from the audience. I want you to have the same story when fate strikes. What if your child drops dead? There'll be parents here, they'll be about to be parents here, planning to be parents in the next few years, whatever. You know, it's one thing to learn about how to bring up a child into this world. So you learn about the child, yes, but learn this about the child as well. So that as a mother, you don't go insane if something unexpected were to happen to your child. There are young ladies here who perhaps will one day go on to become mothers if Anagarika Mahatmyas don't have something to do with them. Then you will go and perhaps, you know, what happens if you have a miscarriage? If at the point of delivery something unexpected happens. If before the child's first birthday something happens to you. You study about the child, you go to the doctor, you do your scans, right? You learn about the child. But this doctor is trying to teach you something else about the child. If you learn what those doctors teach you, you can have a decent birth and the child will be physically okay. As best as possible. But when it's time, it's time. There's nothing in this world that can stop it. And when the inevitable happens someday, science hasn't been able to stop death. It can only postpone death. So when the inevitable happens one day, someday, in that moment, it is this doctor's advice that's going to help you. Not your family physician, but your family monk. Then these words should resonate in your minds. It may be for you, it may be for your children and your children's children. I want you to realize on the day your mother passes away, whenever that day might come for you, cry because it is what is expected from you. Do cry, don't not cry. They'll think you're weird. So do cry. But try and cry crocodile tears. You heard of crocodile tears? Fake tears. Is there any mother in the house, any father in the house who really wishes for their children to be utterly distraught on their funeral? If you say yes to this question, are you really a mother and a father, is the next question I'll have to ask you. Do you really want your children to be broken into pieces on the, you know, when the inevitable happens? Of course not. Any mother who's worth her salt, any father who's worth his salt would not expect that for his children, for their children. They would want their children to be happy no matter what, right? I mean, that must be what motherly and fatherly love is. Don't cry for anything else, but on the day I die, you have to cry. I mean, come on. That can't be right. So therefore, you have to give your children this. The only remedy to the ailing mind which believes that death is something that's going to happen with their mother and their father. It's not. Death only happens in the mind of the observer. What's happening out there is a chitta no longer arising in that body. That's it. If you want to call it death, call it death. That's okay. But what you feel is there's a person that is dying. And when that happens, You can't stop grief. So here's the remedy to grief. Chitta arises. Now you understand this process. I consciousness becomes the object to the mind base. So here's the manovijnana. This is where stuff begins to happen. Your karma begins to happen here, not here. This is all vipaka. Karma can only happen in this space. You understand the difference between karma and vipaka? Vipaka are your results that come to fruition. Karma is the regeneration of those vipakas that keeps you going in samsara. This is how you fuel the process of samsara, by doing karma. So how does karma happen is what I was going to explain to you here. As long as ignorance and attachment are here, ladies and gentlemen, this ignorance is the ignorance that there are entities in this world, that there are sentient beings in this world, that there are things in this world, but all there are entities. See, let me give you one simple example to prove that to you. At this point, it is the combination of all this that is the flower, right? Do you get the point? So where's the flower? Without the rupa, show me the flower. Take out the rupa and show me the flower. Keep the rupa, take out the vedana, show me the flower. Keep the rupa and the vedana, take out the sanya and show me the flower. There's no flower. It's like, I don't know if you can see it from the back. You should be able to now. These are a bunch of people standing in a circle. Are you going to tell me that the circle is independent of the people standing in a circle? Is a circle, can you form the circle independent of the people who are stood in a circle? No, so where is the circle if you take out the people? There is no circle. Bring the people back together, get them to stand in that order. Now you manifest, a circle manifests. So there is no entity of a circle here. It's constantly manifesting. That's why I said it's always in the present continuous. You are being. That's why they call you living beings. They don't call you live be. And if it were the simple present, they would just have to call you live be. That's it, done. No, you are living beings because you are continuously in the present living being. That's what's going on with you right now. Therefore, constantly manifesting. This circle is constantly manifesting. Ask three of the people here to walk away. Where's the circle now? Now you no longer see a circle. So for the circle to be seen, the people should be standing. Standing. Continuously. At any moment if one guy walks away, there's no longer a circle. So do you see it's always manifesting? Then where's the flower? If not for the rupa, the vedana, the sanya, the sankara and the vijnana, if they didn't perform their functions, where would be the rupa? Where would be the flower? See, this is the effect of causes working together. That is how a flower manifests in the mind. But we have a bed of ignorance. This is the mind base. This is the mind base and it's tainted with ignorance. So where there is ignorance, there's this bad knowledge. What knowledge? Bad knowledge. There are two types of knowledge. There's good knowledge and there's bad knowledge. Like, which side of the road do you park? You can park on either side. What if you get it wrong? You think today is an odd day. You park on the even side. That's still knowledge. Someone asks you, why did you park there? Oh, I thought today was an odd day. So they're talking about knowledge. But it's bad knowledge because it leads to suffering. It's still knowledge nonetheless. So the mind can always bear knowledge that is called the Dhamma. Now you see the Mara Dhamma. Nitya, Sukha and Atta. In other words, it is not conditioned. These are entities and they are fixed. This knowledge is bad knowledge. Because this knowledge, if you look at the world through this lens of bad knowledge, ladies and gentlemen, you expect that. from what comes into you. It's like when you see Santa Claus. We talked about the Santa Claus example a while back. Do you all remember Santa Claus? Have you seen Santa Claus? Have you really? You've seen someone dressed up like Santa Claus. You've never seen Santa. So, during Christmas time, when I used to be back in the UK, you had the shopping malls and parents used to go and wrap up presents and give them to the Santa, behind the scenes. And then the children would walk up to the Santa and Santa says, "Ho, ho, ho, who are you?" "My name is Tommy." "Oh, let's see what we have for Tommy." "Give me the gift from Tommy." And so the gift that was wrapped up by Tommy's mother, Santa picks up and says, "Here's what I have for you. Why don't you have a look and see if something you like?" Santa says to Tommy. And so Tommy unwraps his present. "A PS4? He goes, "I always wanted this. How did you know?" "Well, that's because I'm Santa. Santa knows." The poor thing, the kid, so naive. He doesn't know that Santa is a make-believe thing. He thinks he's met the real deal. But you and I, we know that this is just some guy dressed up as Santa. But the kid expects Santa to be there. Now, have you ever heard of Santa getting a heart attack? But a guy who's dressed up as Santa, is he immune to a heart attack? Is he? Is he immune to a call of nature? Won't he need a toilet break from time to time? But Santa doesn't. So from time to time you'll see Santa's gone for a quick call of nature. There's a boat out there. But you think, Santa doesn't need a call of nature. Well, yes, Santa doesn't need it. But the guy who's dressed up as Santa, he's only human. Humans need that. Santa's gone for lunch. Why does Santa need lunch? Santa doesn't need lunch, of course not. But the guy who dresses up as Santa, they need lunch. Now you see, when reality is one, but your expectations are another, there's a clash. There's always a clash. That any time you're disappointed about something or with someone, try and point the finger back at you. If you do that, your efforts will not be in vain. Because at the end of that questioning, at the end of that quest, you will come out victorious. Every time you point the finger outside, whoever is on the other end of that pointing, it might be your husband on most occasions, could be your wife on other occasions, it could be your mother, could be your father, could be your friend, could be your colleague, whoever. If you keep pointing your finger to the outside, ladies and gentlemen, you will never win this battle. Keep on trying to change the outside world while inside you're creating, there's a furnace that you're keeping alive. With the fire of desire, aversion and delusion, you will never win this battle. Because in this game, victory is accepting defeat. Write that down. That's why this game is very different to every other game. That is what an arahant has done. He has accepted defeat and therefore nothing bothers him. He's accepted. He's accepted nature. He has succumbed to nature. Why are you always failing? Why are you always unhappy? Why are you always uncontent or discontent? Why are you disappointed? All the while, something comes from the outside, you have something on the inside, and they keep on clashing. Friction. Conflict. That's why life is painful for you. That's why life sucks. There's always something on the inside that is always in conflict with what comes from the outside. You have not succumbed. You have not accepted defeat. Because once you accept defeat, you are victorious. But there is no other game out there that will teach you this. Because in every other game, They are all worldly, laukika. This is lokottara. Rules of the game that apply to worldly games don't apply to this. Different dynamics, different rules. Because this is the Buddha Dhamma. Everything else is Mara Dhamma. With Mara Dhamma, I have to win. I have to win. With Buddha Dhamma, there is no I to win. You see the difference? You see the difference? Oh, I'm loving this sermon today. Thank you. I'm saying things I've never heard myself say before. Like I said, I don't come with an agenda. We just come and start speaking. Your merit for power comes forward. Mine comes forward. Everything comes forward. The right environment, the right causes, and we get to hear things that I've never heard before. So it's not my doing, you see. It's not my doing. This is all cause and effect. So therefore, in this game, everywhere you accept defeat, you have won. Everywhere you strive, you struggle for victory, you battle for victory, you fight for victory, is a battle you have lost. Think about this. Think about this through the course of the week. Every time you feel that conflict in your heart, in your mind, because as you head back home, you know, people will start coming and talking to you. They will say things to you at the supermarket, on the high street, at home, at work. You know, people come and say all sorts of things to you. They'll want you to do things for them, things that you might not like to do, things you will not want to do. And then there'll always be that conflict inside. Always try and remember, for your sake, what I have shared with you here today. You feel this friction, this heating up, is because two things are in conflict. To generate heat, you need to rub one thing against another. Otherwise, where's heat? You know, this guy keeps pushing, this guy keeps accepting. Where's the heat? Remember when you were younger and you did something mischievous in class, your teacher used to come and pull you by the ear. Remember? And what did you used to do? What did you used to do? You pull back. You were helping the teacher punish you. No? Because the teacher is pulling this way, you're pulling the opposite direction. Otherwise, she's saying, thank you. What should you have done? She might have called you a weirdo. As the teacher comes around, you go, oh. At least she won't try it again. What's he coming to? But you see, you know, succumb. Accept vipaka. And you'll never be hurt. Accept vipaka. This is what we're trying to do here. Equanimity is that. To get to that stage, you have to realize that all are manifestations. They're not entities, because the moment you create entities in your mind, ladies and gentlemen, now you have a story about them. You have a profile for them. This is the profile that the mind starts building here. See, if you are a man, you need to have a profile. That's half that you put on Facebook. That's your profile. When you get home, check your Facebook profile. It will tell you everything that your mind is building up about you. I am this person, I am married to so and so, I went to this school. What, really? You went to that school? Really? This chitta went to that school? This chitta went to that school? This chitta wasn't even born then. Was it? No, this is a newly born, freshly baked chitta. We are talking about light years ago in chitta terms. This chitta wasn't even there then. So how can you say, I'm a royalist? I'm an Anandian. How can you say that? I'm a Peterite. How can you say that? I'm a Visakhian. How can you say that? for you. This chitta is just born. When did this chitta go to school? Try and come to terms about the fact that you are individual chittas that arise and pass away. Then you disappear into insignificance. Right now, you feel you are a somebody. And that somebody must be respected by people around you. They must stand up when you walk in. They might say, "Good morning, sir," when they see you in the morning. So you expect, because once you've built up the profile, now you expect that profile to be acknowledged by the people around you. These are the tricks of the mind that you never learnt at school. In vain was it not for the last 60 years you've been learning about the suns and the planets and the stars. You're still on earth. If you'd spend that time learning about yourself, about how the mind works, about who you really are, just imagine where you would be today. How free you would be. How unstressed you would be. How content you would be. Because what you didn't know was there was a profile that was building up inside each and every chitta, and always expecting that to be acknowledged from the people around you. The moment you begin to think you're a father, you expect your daughter, your son to respect you. If they don't, how do you feel? You know what I'm talking about. The moment you think you're a husband, you expect your wife to be faithful to you. If you don't, you know how that feels. The moment you think you are a friend to somebody else, you expect them to be loyal to you. Remember at school? Are you my friend? I'm your best friend. Okay, then you can't be talking to anybody else. Do you remember when you thought someone was your best friend and they were hugging and embracing and putting their arms around somebody else, how that made you feel? Hold on a second. I thought you're my best friend. See? Building up that profile. Because once that profile has been published, it has to be acknowledged. This is all where ego begins. You're measuring yourselves with each other. All that begins here. That's why whenever you feel that you're better than someone or you're less than someone, ladies and gentlemen, you have yourselves to blame for that. It's all because you're building up a profile and now you're comparing that with whatever comes from the outside. This comparison is the cause of conflict. That is where the friction is. That is where you feel you're heating up on the inside. Let the outside world be. You just come to terms about what's on the outside. Realize, recognize what's on the outside. Learn that this is all vipaka. Excuse me. That these are merely manifestations. Once you recognize and learn and comprehend that these are all manifestations, here's what won't happen in your mind. Once again, once you learn that these are manifestations, here's what will not happen in your mind. You will not expect anything more than a manifestation. You will not expect entities. And therefore, the first thing that's going to happen is you will stop building up a profile that is you. You will recognize that you are merely Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. The source of which is pure Vipaka. Therefore, you are just your Vipaka. So it would be wrong to say your Vipaka. You are just Vipaka. So really, you are just energy. Now don't you see how you can be one with God? Accept that you are everything and you are one with God. So bring me a bunch of Christians, I'll talk to them. And I'll show them how they can be one with God. Anyone who believes in a creator God, I can speak to them. In the language that they'll understand, I can explain to them what the Buddha taught. Because there can't be two versions of the truth. You just need to explain something in a way that someone understands. That's it. To be one with God, to be one with the universe. Yes, you are the universe. You are. Shall I show you everything in this universe at once? You ready for it? Behold this sight, for you will never see it again. I'm going to show you everything in this universe in one instance. Ready? I want you to think about why I claim this to be everything in the universe. Get those cogs turning now. This is homework at school. Get your cogs turning now. Why does Swami Nuhanse say that this is the whole universe in one offering? What is this energy? Energy condensed into one form. If we were to add or take out some of the energy here, we can transform this into any other form. Absolutely any other form. So don't I have the universe in my hand? If this can be transformed to anything else in this universe, don't I have the whole universe in my hand? How about this? How about this? How about this? How about you? Now, are you not the universe? See, now you disappear into insignificance. As you listen to these words at least, right? Perhaps as you walk out this door, sandwich. At least while you're here. At least while you're here. And you're listening to these words, and you're contemplating on them, don't you feel relaxed? Don't you feel yourself cooling down? That engine that has been revving all the while, don't you feel that slowing down a little bit? Don't you experience that serenity? But I don't see any of you sitting down like this. So where's that serenity coming from? I don't see any of you sitting down in isolation, blocking yourself away from all sights and sounds and smells and taste and touch. All the while I'm talking to you, I'm disturbing your silence, aren't I? I'm disturbing your peace and quiet. I'm throwing my arms here and there and everywhere, showing you things and drawing things on the board, sight after sight after sight after sight, sound after sound after sound after sound. So then where's the tranquility coming from? Where's the serenity coming from? It's all through your contemplation of the Dhamma. This is what Samadhi is. When the mind runs together with the Dhamma, your mind is in Samadhi. There are two types of Samadhi mainly, Michcha Samadhi and Samma Samadhi. Michcha Samadhi is whenever the mind is working on Mara Dhamma. That is Michcha Samadhi. The mind continues, as long as the mind believes and thinks in Nitya Sukha Atta, entities exist in this world, and how do I interact with these entities? How do I engage with them? How do I work with them? How can I measure them? Are they better than me? Are they less than me? Do I like them? Do I not like them? How can I distance myself from them? How can I encroach up to them? And how can I make them mine? All of these contemplations, these are all Michcha Samadhi and Michcha Sankappa. But once you reflect on the Buddha's teaching, Anicca Dukkha Anatta, there are no such things called entities. All there are just manifestations. The whole universe is there. Now what do you compare? What do you compare this with? This? If this is the universe and this is also the universe, how can you compare two similar things? Do you get where I'm coming from? Is this making sense, ladies and gentlemen? How can you compare two identical things? There is nothing to compare. There is nothing to contrast. They are identical. Just a different configuration. I'm not saying that this is a pen or this is a duster. We use this to write, we use this to erase. Yes, I accept that. Excuse me. But what I'm saying is, These are merely configurations. They are not fixed entities. So at any point you can transform this to this. At any point you can transform this to this. How does water become ice? How does ice become water? How does chicken become you? You're just a chicken waiting to happen. No? Whatever we put in comes out the other end. You know, if there's some kind of plantation, some cultivation there, maybe some grains have been are being grown there, then that becomes a fertilizer. Now the chicken needs the grain. Now what have they just eaten? Human? Is it a grain they have eaten? A grain of rice? Or is it a human they have eaten? Or has the chicken just begun to eat chicken again? So then don't you eat human? It would be right or wrong to say that you eat human or that you eat chicken. It's wrong. Because you cannot explain reality in those terms. Ones and zeros don't go to explain this world. You can't explain this world in ones and zeros. But that is why we are so advanced now that everything in this world is a one and a zero. See what science is doing to you. As you start digressing from the true science, that is the science that was taught by the great master, the greatest scientist that we have ever seen. As we start digressing, moving away, shifting from the true science, we create our own sciences. And today people talk about molecules and atoms, they're all the while speaking about entities. That is why people keep on dividing until they get to the indivisible entity. You know, they started with the molecule, then they broke it down into the atoms, then that they broke down into the electrons and neutrons and electrons, then they started breaking it down into the quarks. They'll keep on going until they find the indivisible particle. Even if they come across some, and they say it's all energy, in their mind they're thinking energy is a constant. Energy is a thing. It's an entity. They can't get their minds out of this thinking that nothing is an entity. They are just manifestations that manifest given the present causes, given the present conditions. That's all it is. You are only human because the environment is conducive in the present moment to manifest you as human. That's it. You are not just a fixed human being. So don't take it for granted. Don't take things as a given. You're not a given human being. It's just manifesting. Right now. But in a base of ignorance and attachment, there's always a lookout. There's always a search for something that is an entity. This is the bad knowledge that the mind possesses. It is that bad knowledge I'm taking every effort here to try and change. That's all I can do. That is all I can help you with. To change that knowledge. Replace the bad knowledge with good knowledge. After I've done that, is there anything else I need to do as well? What do you think? After I've replaced your bad knowledge with good knowledge, is there anything else I need to do? Nothing more I need to do. Other than giving you Samma Ditti. And also teaching you what you need to do as your practice. To incorporate that into your minds. To make that your operating system. Once I've shown you what they call the Pratipada. So you need two things from a teacher. One, the instruction, the teaching. Two, how you practice it. Once you have those two things, everything else is simply the requisites. Because you have to sustain your body for as long as the mind needs the time to assimilate this. This is what I do as a bhikkhu. You provide the four requisites. My teacher gives me instruction and tells me how to do it, not just what to do, but how to do it. And with these three things coming this way, transformations begin to happen here. I start to think differently. I start to perceive the world differently. And where I used to see entities, I begin to see manifestations. And once that has happened, no more comparisons. no more affections, no more afflictions, none of that. No desires, no aversions, no delusions. That is Nibbana. Etam santam, etam panitam. Yum, yum, yum. Age is not a symbol or a measure of maturity. People think as we age, we will mature. Really? Let me show you an example of that. If you believe age is a measure of maturity, you believe that's going to solve all your problems. It's not so, ladies and gentlemen, not until you come across the true teaching. So then it doesn't matter whether you're young or you're middle-aged or you're old. Every chitta is a fighting chance. That is what you do by bringing yourselves here. And like I said, it's wonderful to see that several of you are now making appearances at the monastery. And I think it's not because, you might come there because I say so, but I don't think you'll stay a few days because I say so. In fact, most of the time you don't even get to see me. But you spend time in the association of the Mahasangha. This includes the monks. This includes the Anagarika Mahatyas. This includes the Anagarika Mahatmyas. This includes the Sila Shravikas, the Sila Shravakas. This includes the Uyasis. These are all programs that we have created at the monastery so that people who cannot give themselves up 100% because they have other duties and responsibilities, these are the programs that we have created at the monastery so that people can come and practice whatever time is available to them. Whatever time is available to them. If you have only 2 days a week, there's a program for that. Just come the 2 days a week. We feed you, we shelter you, and give you the Dhamma, the path to Nibbana. These will be the only 2 days that will be worthwhile when this life is done. All other things done will simply be a means to an end, that is death. Anyhow, I want to explain to you and show you that age does not mean maturity. What do you think is going on there? What are they scared of? A shadow. Right? Now, I've already given you a lecture. I want you to think why this is happening. On YouTube, people will like and share and comment and they say, oh, so sweet, this kid is. I need you to think about this in a different light. Because you have understood the Dhamma. It's alright, have a laugh, it's fine. But as you do that, think about what's going on in this mind. Is this the baby? Is this a child? Or is it simply a mind that is arising with ignorance and attachment? And therefore, what is going on inside? Because we are mind scientists. That's what we are. Okay? So as a good scientist, I want you to observe this and try and build up some conclusions. Right, please carry on. Now, what do you think about that? What's going on there? Is it just because they're children? I mean, can that be a scientist's explanation? It's because they're children. So you're telling me then adults don't do that sort of thing? I have another video. You tell me that it's only kids that do this kind of thing, children do this kind of thing, so immature, they're just naive. Huh? They're so gullible. That's why they do these things. Because they're kids. As they grow up, they will mature and then they'll begin to understand the world and then they won't do things like that. Really? See, we crack a joke up and we laugh about this, right? We see how childish what these people, these young children are doing. And so it's a child, so doing childish things is to be expected, is what you tell yourself. What does a child think the shadow is? Why is this child scared? What does he think the shadow is? Huh? A being. It thinks that's a person. The child thinks this is some kind of beast, some animal, something that's out to get it. But what is it really? Just a shadow. Can you see some analogies here? Can you see how that relates to what we've been discussing so far? What are you after all? Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. But what do you perceive yourself as? Sumanasekarasan, Samaravirasan, Vijay Vikramasan. This is what you perceive yourself as. It's okay for you to do that, but it's not okay for the child. What's going to happen after a while is the child is going to be taught by its parents, darling, that's just your shadow. And then what they're ignorant about now, they become knowledgeable about, and therefore they become wise. What do the parents have to do to make that transformation within them? Rid the bad knowledge, replace it with good knowledge. So what is my task again? Rid the bad knowledge, replace it with the good knowledge. Well done, children. So this is what the parents do with their children. So then you'd think, so growing up is maturity, then all we need to do is just grow up. You don't need to spend our time discussing anicca, dukkha, anatta. It's just a child that thinks the shadow is a being. That's why the child is scared. Right now you know that out of moha spring raga and dvesha. What you saw on screen there was what? Raga or dvesha. That is dvesha. This is aversion. Because scared, fear, you know, these are all manifestations of dvesha. But it's only a child, right? So it's understandable, right? Okay. Right. Now, put your hand up if you know where this is. Madame Tussauds, yes. So, a few blank faces in the audience. Let me explain. There's a place called Madame Tussauds where they have wax figures. And what's so special about these figures are, they're the spitting image of the person that they're meant to represent. So what you saw that person standing next to is not the real person, but that's a wax image that has been carefully and masterfully crafted by an artist, right? So there's a place like that, and I remember going there in my, donkeys years ago, when I was that, right? I remember going up there, queuing up an hour and a half of my human life, queuing up outside Madame Tussauds, then to buy a ticket that cost me 45 quid, 45 pounds, to enter so that I could go and stand next to these wax figures and then take selfies and take pictures and then to think to myself that I am stood next to the real person. Now you tell me, for the child it's silly to be scared of its own shadow because it's not the real thing. You said that was aversion. What is this then? So age matures. Why do people do this? Here's why people do this. When you look at a rupa, if the perception of sentience arises in the mind, in other words, if you get this sanya that it is an animal, a being, an entity that you want to associate. When people are there, now this person is not standing next to the real person. I can't remember these actors' names now, it's been too long to remember. Anyone? Samuel Jackson, thank you. So that's not the real Samuel Jackson there. He's just a wax figure. But, do you see how he's queued up? Walked in with his partner, I presume. And now they're standing next to the guy, posing for a picture. These pictures they'll take them home with them, and they'll watch them, they'll share with their friends. All the while they're stood next to a bundle of wax. It's just a bowl of wax. But why do people do that? Because it matters not what's out there. What matters is how you feel about it. Your perceptions drive your behaviors. That is why you're married to a man. That's why you're married to a woman. It matters not what's out there. There is no man or woman out there. What matters is what you perceive. Your perceptions drive your behaviors. So the only reason you can spend a happily married life right now is thankfully because you're a little bit insane. Hasn't your other half been telling you that? Right, please continue. How do we make sense of this world? Now do you think I have what towards people living in this world? Utter sympathy. These people, because I was there once. That's why I know what it feels like. I went to the gig. I bought that t-shirt. I chewed on that bone. So I know that it has no meat. I know it. But I had no alternative. Yesterday we were discussing about this. Once you have the rash and it feels itchy, unless you have an alternative, you have no choice but to scratch. Because it hurts. What can you do? You just have to scratch it. This is what people do in the pursuit of happiness. They queue up, walk into a museum of wax figures, and sometimes they'll spend the whole day there, and their hard-earned cash, sometimes hungry, sometimes thirsty, posing for pictures. I'm not mocking them. Please don't think that way. I have sympathy towards them. If only these words could reach those people, they'll begin to realize that the value of human life is wasted there. The only reason that they are able to do that is they can look at a rupa and inside of them a director begins to do his direction. A sentient being is constructed in the mind. It's not out there. You know for certain they're not out there. This is just the rupa. It's just wax. But why don't people just go and stand next to a bowl of wax and take pictures? Because that way, that figure is not sufficient for them to, for the mind to inspire itself to create a sentient being. And that's why, when you grow older, you become less attractive to the people around you. Because your rupa no longer ticks the boxes that have thus far helped them, supported them, and enabled them to create this wonderful, attractive, sentient woman or man, sensual woman or man that they've always managed to do by looking at your figure. Aren't you fighting a losing battle? Trying to keep it all together? Ladies, the attraction will fade. Then you are at the mercy, at his mercy, at the mercy of ignorance and attachment. A lot of the time these things happen in families. When they got together, they started living happily. But time takes its toll. 10 years later, 15 years later, 20 years later, the wrinkles start to appear, the hair starts to grey, the what was smart once begins to wither, slim and slender begin to become fat, and I think Then you begin to wonder, why am I not any longer attractive? Why does my husband not find me attractive anymore? Because you didn't bring him to the sermons, that's why. You took him to Madame Tussauds. If you had brought him to the sermons, he would have learned that this is not a wife, but merely a manifestation. What we see are simply the causes and their effects. He would have begun to understand that even inside this, his own body is just manifestations of matter and energy. At that point, he will begin to realize that there are no things or entities in this world that can be compared with each other. Because to compare, you need two things. One inside, one outside. They must both be things. If they are only manifestations, like I say, this is the universe, this is also the universe. How do you compare? So therefore, one day you're going to lose this battle. Most of the time, whether you know it or not, I won't say all of the time, most of the time, whether you know it or not, they will start to pick up a younger partner. Not all of the time, I don't want to offend anyone. But most of the time, they'll find interest in another partner. They'll find another person attractive. And then when that day comes, all you can do is weep and cry. And ask yourself, is this what I signed up for? And then what you'll do to fight that, you'll get all your makeup done. You'll do your makeovers, you'll do your Botox, the injections and the cutting here, slicing there, shaping yourselves up as much as you can hold it together. But for how long? See, what you're trying to do is to keep that rupa intact so that the person that's observing you can continue to have this image created in their own mind, this mental image in their own mind that you are still what they wanted. Because that image hasn't changed. But your image is changing. That image hasn't changed because that image is influenced by the drushti that they have, by the ignorance that they have, the attachment that they have. So therefore there's always going to be conflict. What was raga once will be dvesha later. Love and hate are simply two sides of the same coin. So what do you do then? When you can no longer sell your appearances in exchange for shelter? Too harsh? When you can no longer sell your appearances in exchange for a meal? What do you do then? That's why if you want to seek refuge in the Dhamma. So that even if they give up on you entirely, even if they go looking for another partner, this applies to both sexes equally. In some places it's the other way around. For as long as happiness is conditional, you can only do so much to maintain those conditions. And it becomes a lifelong struggle to try and maintain those conditions. You know this. How much have you spent already at the salons? How much have you spent already doing up your hair? How much have you spent already doing up your skin and the rest of your bodies? All the while trying to maintain this figure that the rest of the world find attractive and therefore they acknowledge you. They acknowledge you and they recognize you. Because that recognition is very important to you. You want to be acknowledged, you want to be recognized because there's a profile that's building inside your mind. So that profile has to be accepted from the outside. You're looking for attestation. This is the curse, ladies and gentlemen. So open your eyes and understand what's going on here. So first and foremost, take sympathy upon yourselves. Empathize with yourselves. Start metta with yourselves. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fire of desire. This is noble metta. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fires of aversion. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fire of delusion. Because that is the only bliss, the only happiness, the only contentment and fulfillment that we can hope for. A state of mind where there is no desire, aversion or delusion. Start with yourself and spread it outwardly. Because you're fighting a losing battle. This is the only battle that you can win. And to win it, you just have to accept defeat. That's the irony of it. It goes against everything we are used to doing. We've never used to be like that. To win, accept defeat, who does that? But this is a different game altogether. So do you see, age does not equate to maturity. That young child, those children that you saw, the babies, the children that you saw, they had fear within them. That was aversion. Because they were looking at their own shadows. They were looking at their own shadows. But in their minds, they were creating a creature, an entity. And therefore, the two of them were at conflict. So they had not succumbed to nature. But what's going to happen eventually is that parents, the teachers, whoever, they're going to teach them, kid, that's just a shadow. That's just nature. Accept it. Ah, got it. So then they're no longer scared of that, afraid of that. That's what you consider aging, maturity. But then why do the adults go to Madame Tussauds? How do you convince them to stop that? I mean, you don't have to stop it. But what's going on there is suffering. Although people say they're going on a trip to enjoy themselves, what's really going on there is suffering. Why do I say that? Because it's all based on ignorance and attachment. As long as ignorance and attachment are there, it is dukkha that is forming in the mind. And as long as dukkha is forming in the mind, there's going to be ragagini, dveshagini, mohagini, the fires of desire, aversion and delusion. That's what's going on. The reason they're happy when they see those figures is because vexation has built up in their minds and they're relieved from that vexation every single time they do it. Vexation and relief cannot be the secret to happiness. A truly happy mind is free of vexation altogether. So therefore, age does not mean maturity. To mature, you have to have embraced the Buddha's teaching. Out with the old, out with the bad, and in with the new and the good stuff. This is knowledge I speak of. So this is the wisdom I wish to impart. Did all that make sense to you? Yes? Good. Lastly, I want to show you something. So, someone reminded me we've done these sermons for like 30 odd weeks or so. And over those last few months, several months, I think we started in June, first week of June, I think. Yes, just after Vesak, we started in the first week of June. You have all been coming along, and as you've been progressing in the Dhamma, finding your solid solace and finding your own salvation, You have also contributed in many ways, in numerous ways, towards the mission of the sasana. The extent to which you have understood what the sasana has done for you, you do in return for the sasana. I want to show you a few instances of how your contributions have gone into prospering the sasana. What is the sasana again? Sabba papasa karanam, kusala supasampada, sachitta pariyodapanam, etam buddhana sasana. It is not the kuti. It is not the shrine rooms. It is not the dhamma halls. It is not the grand stupas. It is not even the Buddha statues. It is sabba papasa akarana. If what you have contributed has helped a mind, a chitta, a human being, to stop engaging in unmeritorious deeds, now you have contributed towards the sasana. Sabba papasa akarana. If your contributions have led towards one to get themselves on the path to Nibbana, to cultivate wholesomeness, to engage in more merits and to practice the Dhamma, kusalasya upasampada. If by doing that, they have been able to free themselves from suffering, and that is your intention always, whatever I contribute, whatever I offer to the sasana, that could be a robe, that could be an alms bowl, that could be a vatata, it could be money, whatever it might have been. For some of you, it would have been a thank you. Maybe it would have been a smile to someone else who came along. Because that smile brought them back. And then that stopped them from doing unmeritorious deeds. Because they got to listen to the teaching, because they came back because you smiled at them. It might have been the sandwich. It might have been you offering a seat to them. Might have been a glass of water. Might have been kindly, gently showing them where the lavatories are. They would have been utterly impressed. Wow, what great men and women come together here. What a great community. All of that is all sasana if they have contributed and you have, with intention, done these three things. What three things again? Sabba papa sakarana, kusala supasampada, sachitta pariyodapana. If this has been your intention from the start, ladies and gentlemen, it is not the size of what you have offered that matters. It is always your intention. If your intention has always been that, I want you to witness what you will be seeing on screen today and rejoice in all the goodness that you have all together been able to gift mankind. Everything you have offered so far, whether that is an envelope you leave at the end or whether it is a robe that you offer us, have all gone into doing these three things. Most of the time at our monastery, we never go out asking for people to help us build this or build that. We don't do that. Because we believe that it is forbidden by our practice, by our teaching, by our discipline, to ask people for anything. That's why I bring my arms forward and I stand there like a beggar. Should you choose to offer something, that is your choice. If you don't, then that is your choice as well. My task is merely to create an environment that is conducive to your giving. Whether you give or not is absolutely your decision. When we go on arms around the towns and cities, that is again the same thing. So the same concept applies throughout. So whatever you have seen at the monastery from time to time when you come there, on no occasion to this day, I'm happy to say, have we ever gone out and asked anyone, please can you contribute to building this, to building that, to building whatever. So how do we do it, you might ask? No, we don't do jobs. We don't earn money. Because once again, that is not what we are here for in the sasana. But you might offer a robe. You might offer a pirikara for a robe. We are clever though. And we have learnt a lot thanks to our teachers. So what might take an average person, say 5,000 rupees, 10,000 rupees, whatever, to give an alms offering? We save. We are very thrifty. Because we understand that we are spending your hard-earned cash, not ours. This is money you have donated towards the sasana. So most of what you see at the monastery, unless someone has come forward and said, I would like to offer a kuti, the Dhamma halls, no one takes that up as a project. Most of the time people like to offer a kuti. Because, I mean, it's not something that one person can do. You know, these are massive construction projects to house thousands of people. If you've come to the monastery, you've seen how many people get together for an event and so on. So it's not something one individual can do. So what we do is, whatever offerings we get, we cut down on our comforts as much as we possibly can. And then we save. We keep saving that. We keep saving that until it is enough for us to build a Dhamma hall. And then we build one. And then you come and listen to the Dhamma. And then you decide, I also want to become an Anagarika. And then you decide to stay with us. And then we have to build a kuti, so that you can be housed in one, because you can no longer be in the Dhamma hall. So then, we continue that. Again, someone comes and offers maybe an Atapirikara. Now, we are not in the business of stocking Atapirikaras at the monastery. That's not what we build the Dhamma halls for, to stock Atapirikaras. Right? It's space that is very important. This is prime space for people to come and sit down and listen to the Dhamma. For people to come and meditate, practice the path. We're not going to fill up these rooms with Atapirikaras. We're not a storeroom. So we have worked out with help from our charity trust, which is the Punya Bhara. So we have established a charity trust, which is run by lay devotees who are very loyal to the Buddha Sasana. They themselves are practitioners of the Dhamma. But they have kept themselves from ordaining themselves because they consider it their duty to prosper the sasana and to look after the sasana, because as Swaminarayan says, we can't do and deal with money and such matters. I mean, that is such a sacrifice, if you ask me. To let me do what I am doing, someone else has decided that they're going to stay as a layperson and commit themselves entirely to do that, to look after that aspect of the sasana. So these are the names that you will hear from time to time when we speak about Mr. Harsha and so on. These are the individuals that you will be speaking on the end of the phone. Not just he alone, but a group of people, a team of people, who are also practicing the Dhamma alongside. So they have gone and found ways in which we can convert an Atapirikara that we don't need. Would you rather me stock up Atapirikaras, or would you rather me somehow convert that Atapirikara to something that can help us buy a bag of cement, so that we can build a structure, so that you can come and join a meditation program? What would you rather? Exactly. Because we don't want a loss to the sasana. So this is what we do at the monastery. I remember when I was a lay person, when I had the means to do it and I earned my own money, I used to spend for luxury. But then when the thought occurred in me that we have to go and ordain, and for that we have to buy a piece of land to build a monastery so that many people could come and practice the path, those days we used to go to the premium supermarkets, and then that all boiled down to good old Tesco values. So I remember going to the supermarket just an hour or two before they close, because what they do is they discount things that are going off date, and that would help me save a few pounds here, a few pounds there, everything, because all that was on behalf of the sasana. If I could sell my kidney for the sasana, I would, ladies and gentlemen. I've only got one liver, I can't give that, unfortunately. But if it comes to that, and a Dhamma hall needs to be built, a kuti needs to be built so that a few of you can come and practice with them, and we can't do that because we don't have enough, I'm prepared to give my kidney. As long as I'm here and I can practice the path until I've completed my journey, if I can survive on what I've got, that's enough. I've told my teacher, if ever it is needed, Venerable Sir, please let me know. I'm happy to do that. Because it is an opportunity that I have. I'm not making donations to the sasana. Remember, it's not a donation. The sasana is an opportunity for us to invest so that the sasana repays me in Nibbana. That's what we're doing. So what I want to show you is, all of the offerings that you have been making, whether it is a single rupee or a pirikara, whatever it might have been, how they have gone into building a place over the last several months which has enabled many young people just like yourselves, many people to come in, walk through our gates and commit themselves to the practice of Nibbana. So what I want you to do, ladies and gentlemen, is as you watch it, think not how much you have contributed, because there is no you to contribute. Think about the goodness that has happened in this world. Do you know how to watch a cricket match and enjoy it? Do you? To enjoy a cricket match, you shouldn't be taking a side. If you take a side, you can only enjoy either the strikes or the catches. To enjoy both of them, you don't take a side. You enjoy cricket, not a side. This is what I mean by this. When you watch this, don't think of what your contribution was. Don't measure it in terms of that. When the Jetavanarama was offered, there was a man who was stood by the side who had not offered a single penny, but he rejoiced in goodness and he got more than the person who actually made the donation. So watch it, enjoy it, rejoice how much goodness has been happening in this world and how many more people will benefit as a result of that. Let's watch it, please. If only I could show you the happiness that you have helped create in people's hearts and minds. Oh, how I wish I could show you that on a video. Because that is the ultimate impact of all that. All of this is a means to that. It's a path to that. This is the monastery that we have all built together. That's why it would not be right for you to make an offering today and then for us to never talk about it again. I want you to rejoice in this. Even if you do nothing more from here on, next year I'll show you another one of what you have done towards the sasana. Like I said, it doesn't mean you have to pull something out of your pocket, ladies and gentlemen. The smile on your face is enough. What has brought another person back here was the smile on your face, was your thank you, your politeness, your courteousness. Don't you think that's an offering to the sasana? What is the sasana? Sabba papasa karana, kusala subha sampada, sachitta pariyodapanam. These three things, if you can inspire that and motivate that in the mind of a human soul, you have given to the sasana. All these things that go around, the decorations, this is not just a waste of time. This has great value. Because as you witness this, as you see what's going on behind the decorations here, all the hard work that goes into meticulously arranging all this, it creates a sense of joy within your heart, does it not? When you see something nice, when you see something beautiful has been made as an offering to the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, that creates a sense of joy within you. And that sense of joy is the anuttara punya ketta, which once you sit down to listen to the Dhamma, now your heart is joyful. So therefore it makes my job easier to preach to you. Now tell me, this is one man band. Every single week is a different thing. It's not just a flower pot in front of the Buddha, although that would have been sufficient. It's not just that. Well thought through, well crafted, well designed. I mean, something like this would cost what, so much out there? Very professional, don't you think? This is not an amateur job. It's very professional. I mean, I don't know exactly what's behind me right now. I only get to see this in the pictures because I come here and I want to look at your faces. But you get to see this. This is the collective effort. I honestly mean this. 100%. And I want you to rejoice in that. Each and every one of you has had a part to play in it. And whatever part you have played has made such a big influence, such a big impact on many people's lives. And may all those merits that we have all accumulated throughout the past year help us to progress further and further in this year as you begin to unravel and make sense of the sublime teaching of the Buddha. And we all move together forward on our path to freedom from suffering once and for all. So with that in mind, let us take a moment to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today and bring the sermon to a close. So first and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is available today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer these merits to all the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them and creating an environment that is conducive to their practice. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to the friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them fulfill the path to Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha and provide for the construction of the monastery, as well as robes, arms, medicines and so on, as well as those who extend their know-how and continue to pass on their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits equally. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May by the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, and those who have gone the extra mile every single time on our behalf to help us, support us and assist us selflessly. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May by the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the Nimas, gods and deities who have committed themselves to protect and preserve in the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have passed away in our name, our loved ones, our forefathers, our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to live the comforts and enjoy the bliss of Nibbana and work our way towards that salvation, that goal, that destiny, that destination. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrifice their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who would have lost their lives in the war, be their friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to all those who would have lost their lives to natural disasters such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, blizzards, as well as the pandemics from time to time. May they all rejoice in these merits wherever they might be, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, teachers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us. So with an abundance of compassion and loving kindness to all of them, let us transfer all the merits we have acquired. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plain. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I And everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahat Teranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnan midatnva Dvesha ginnan midatnva Moha ginnan midatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Mamada siyalu loka Siyalu satnvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivansata Nivansata ladeva Nivansata ladeva
Tunvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen Silu loka silu satyama Nibbana parama sukhen suvita taravetva Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.